I'm excited to have Neely here. He looks very exciting. And excited.
Yeah. The man in the picture.
There he is. Neely Tchaikovsky was born in Los Angeles and attended Los Angeles State College, now Cal State Los Angeles. He is the author of many books of poetry and has also published bilingual editions in Austria, Mexico, and Italy. His papers are held at the Bancroft Library, University of California, Berkeley. Tchaikovsky received the 2017 Jack Miller Poetry Prize awarded at the Jack Miller Festival in Fruita, Colorado. He has lived in San Francisco since 1974. Very happy to have you here, Neely.
Yeah.
Wasn't Neely previously here in a little magazine called Polis? Yeah.
He might have appeared in a magazine by Polis put out by somebody I might be married to.
James Cook.
I don't remember Polis.
Well, it was a very, very popular magazine.
I was in that?
That's what they say.
Okay.
I think maybe John Landry roped you in.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. All right.
So.
I don't even know what books are in my... And I was looking at this book, and you know, some things happen. It probably happened to some of you who are poets. I don't remember some of the poems being in here. I didn't realize I had a Kerouac poem in here. I have one that's going to be in my new book, but it's going to be there. And this book, Elegy for My B Generation, I sort of been haunted all my life because by the Beats, because I came at the tail end. David Meltzer said, I thought I was the tail end, you're the tail end. And Ferlinghetti says, Neely, you're one of us, you know. And so I'm sort of cursed with that. And I met Bukowski when I was 15, and we did a magazine together. He dedicated his book, Septuagenarians 2, to me. About 25, he said, I'm sending you this book. There's something in it you'll like and something in it you won't like. And I got the book in the mail, and it said, for Neely Tchaikovsky. And I immediately called him up and said, that's the best thing you ever wrote. And then I started looking through the book, and I found a short story about the poet Harold Norris and I being jealous of Bukowski. And this is we're in San Francisco. He's in L.A. And it's sort of a thinly disguised me and a thinly disguised Norris. And I thought it was great. I wouldn't call it, there was no sense of envy. There was a sense of wanting some of the same thing. Not didn't have to be as much, but some of it. But somebody asked me in L.A. 2 years ago, what was the competition like between you and Bukowski? I said, well, he's dead and I'm alive. And that's one thing. That's not very charitable, but he would have liked that. Because he said one day, he said, I'm going to be down there in my grave and I'm going to pull you under. But I did stand there and he didn't do that.
That's a nice cemetery though, right?
Where yeah. Buried, yeah. But the thing is, you get typecast. And, you know, I told this guy the other day, I said, look, if you're talking about who my favorite poet, who would I take to the desert island? I'd probably take everybody, but in reality, in truth, the person, I would probably take Ezra Pound, for sure. There's no doubt about it, the Pisan Cantos particularly, and even more so than that, his translation of the Confucian Odes, because they do what I think I do. And the other thing is people say, what kind of poet are you? And I say, in my own mind, I'm a nature poet before I'm anything else. I did a book recently called, actually it's called In the Odes for Confucius and Ezra Pound. It's only 18 pages of about 200 pages. And it's all about nature and man subsumed within nature. And I got that from the Confucian Odes, which were old folk ballads and poems and such compiled by Confucius, which would have been about, what, 350 BC, and stuff that was written 400 or 500 years earlier, sort of like what the Homeric tradition, gathering all this earlier stuff from the early Greeks and putting it into the Iliad and the Odyssey. So that would be, and the other one would probably be Eliot, even though I have a poem I may read tonight that really sort of blasts him. Because Eliot's anti-Semitism, I sort of excuse the awful collaboration of Pound because I think he was insane. I mean, I came to that in judgment, at least in that period. I think he was crazy. But he wasn't, you know, they had him in the cage at Rapallo, open air cage for a while, and he starts translating Confucius. And he's put in the asylum instead of putting him on trial for treason. He wasn't treasonous, but I excuse him for that. Eliot grew up in St. Louis, and his mother said that Jews were like loathsome animals. Eliot had a friend at Harvard named Norbert Wiener, who some of you know, great scientist. They were very close, but he didn't like Jews all that much, and you can see it in the poetry. And you know, there's people of great intellect why they have to do stuff like that. But his poetry is so incredible. And well, what does it matter? What the fuck does it matter what I like? What? But anyway, it matters to me. This is called Jack Carver. Are you alive? I saw you last in 1959 or 60. But you remark. I hear your voice as you throw a Bunsen burner into the stove and put on your red robes. I, who believed almost no one, I did not trust the textbooks or the school board. I would look at the wall clock and at the dinosaurs in my theater. I would examine the physiques of fellow students, Sabota and Speer, Cruz and Lawton, names in a carnival where cops were slobs, Ferris wheels scraped the sky. You were a port for me. You understood perfectly and read my poems to our class when I was sick at home and told them something about poetry that seemed to stick as they came with their slide rules in hand and said, Mr. Carver told us to look into the earth and feel the scheme beyond science. Are you 88 years old, living in a yellow stucco house? Are you alive? Did they file you away in a rest home? I hope you are 100 years old and still preparing the lesson. I forgot about you until one afternoon you appeared in my studio. My body has no weight. I am forever a child of dark, damp tunnels under the pyramids. I love you, Jack Carver. I had to go on to a solar eclipse and the fall of America. Today, a brontosaurus knocked on the door. She was raising money for the dead students. I had nothing to offer, just my good wishes. I pray you are still alive, and if not, that your heart lives on in the heat of a cosmic mystery, and that soon I'll follow with a white rose in my arms, and that we will meet under the canopy. So that's obviously somebody from the past who we've all had teachers like that. But he gave me A's in the science course for writing poetry. That's pretty amazing.
All right.
And you can hold on. I learned from David Meltzer, in fact, tell people, hold off on applause till the end, because then you might get an ovation. Even with just a few people in the room. So, and Self-Portrait 2018. I write a lot of these, especially when I turn whatever age. And lovely morning under the sun. It sits over my left shoulder and seems to be stalled. I'll need to take action once I have another espresso. In less than 35 days, my self-portrait will be 73. Night will fall. Day might rise over brown rooftops. The monster may move of its own accord. It has been quite reliable. I shut my eyes and look at sunlight. Teeth have decayed. They used to take me kicking and screaming to the dentist. His name was Dr. Pleasant. Even as a young, even at a young age, middle-class poverty was all that mattered. It kept me sane. It allowed me to grow wealthy. It gave me the sun and the moon's dark side, allowing me to wander through the city of the dead, fighting for vanity and humility, looking for love in the wrong places. 73, goodness. Surely it comes down to basics like living with a good man for 35 years. I told him I was a screenwriter. It sounded rich and glamorous. Then he saw my car with its torn upholstery. It comes like a downpour. You run for it. It doesn't allow for error, only for correction and a search for erudition. Oh, mother, you saw me with my hair combed when you were dying. You said I was handsome. You held out your arms. You sank into freedom, and I mussed my hair. I have a head tick and ADD. That's attention deficit disorder, and do not listen well. My heroes are dead or deranged. They lead me across the swollen river. They restore me when I am old. 73, it isn't easy. When was it ever? I need attention. Walt Whitman sitting on a log. Miss Dickinson, who is able to entice a bee out of hiding. Bring it on. I'm drinking from the chalice. Life is a life in poetry, I suspect. Yeah. Motel 6 offers flat TV screen and a work desk, coffee and tuna sandwich at an all-night restaurant. Lady chomps hamburger, juice drips onto her plate. She wears purple nylons and harangues a wrinkled prune eating fried chicken. I fill pages of my notebook, leaving mayonnaise stains. A snowflake drowns in a pool of shit, but don't tell anyone. Helplessly hyper, nerves bent, unable to perform at high altitude, unless out of sorts. Waitress paces the counter, thinks bingo match, folds napkins while pouring coffee. She argues with a cook who curses in Spanish. Hyper lips eating, drinking, worried about making matters count. I do not wish to sit still holding the menu. I need to jump up and head south onto the fast lane, listening to country and western, shutting my eyes for 10 seconds at a time. Sit still, learn to listen, finish what you started, meditate, pet a weasel. The engine purrs. Interchanges appear and disappear. I could drive for hours, lit by darkness, drive into the basin with its concrete river, finally Buddha-like over the grapevine, clinging frost-colored asphalt, singing, oh, my darling Clementine. Snow pelts window glass, hyper-pilgrim, tapping fingers on dashboard and sipping Diet Coke. Blame the bulldog for my travail. Motor purrs, wind whispers, headlight secure, night truckers, sweat drugs. I snatch a tranquil moment and wave it like a flag, dazzled by the depths of asphalt and rubble. Engine continues purring as I pull off for gas. No matter, a light drizzle somewhere in my heart. Mother would be proud. Grandmother would say, oh, what a good boy you are. So quiet and well-mannered. So this book is called, I mean, that's the idea of the book. I love poets. Egocentric poets. Erotic poets. Poor poets. Wealthy poets. Left-wing poets. Right-wing poets. Vain and humble ones, liberal ones, circumspect poets, award-winning poets, unknown ones, poets who praise others, poets who tear other poets down, Jewish poets, agnostic, Buddhist, smug, rhyming, extreme, self-designed outlaw poets, young, old, Christian, transgender, white, black, European, Irish poets, Inuit, every possible poet, anonymous, world famous, loud or quiet, handsome, pretty, ugly, fat, Jain, Hindi, peace-loving activist, homebody poet. I long for the poet who comes out of the stark, dark nowhere above the furthest star, and the one who visits me tomorrow in my neighborhood cafe. That sort of covers the waterfront. And sort of continuing the theme, poems and more poems, until the world does not exist as we had known it. Antique poems by closet homosexuals, closet poems by pious monks, cloistered poems, poems like those Rambo wrote before he had had enough, careful poems of morbid joy, haiku over Pearl Harbor back in the day, rhymes in Sanskrit and Hebrew, second-rate verse on the internet, bad poets at the open mic, bad poets in the universities, bad poets garnering awards for their dumbass verse, serene versifiers with nothing negative in their stanzas, overconfident poets, left-wing poets loving the applause for a poem about the homeless, selfish poets not wanting to share their words in private. You would have to beg them to share. Unstable words, hopeless romanticism, idiots of language, hoarders of emotion and lack of the same, poems for dreamers and for cat freaks, a cycle of sonnets in praise of icebergs, castles of poetry, MFA programs, doctoral degrees, National Poetry Day and National Poetry Month, and a poet laureate for every occasion. I don't write a lot of poems about poetry. I just happen to be reading. I'm going to get to the trees and the birds. I was watching the seagulls. One seagull seemed to be attacking another one down here on East Main about an hour ago, and then it seemed like they were really playing. I don't know, their wings are flapping wide, and then watching a seagull soar. But it's the same as on the West Coast. There doesn't seem to be much difference. Jew, 2015. You thought they made you of clay or gold, but you are a Jew, a son of desert people, chosen by fate to wander with an alphabet of goats and lambs. You thought they poured concrete and built a tower of glass and blew bubbles and wrote a nasty, savage mystery as to how you came to live and to die in this world filled with iron bars, bronze weapons, and stone implements. You slept in Babylon and dreamed of Homer. You wept on the cold stone of a pagan temple rooted in dream. You cannot hide in his words. They fill up with sand. You thought that milk and honey would do it, or that wine and roasted lamb and pistachios would do it. You believed the lion would do it, or the hippo bathing in the river. You wanted to be a Chinese sage, but now you sit on the Beijing Stock Exchange. You are still a Jew, pure and simple. You should have been a disheveled monk hiding in a cave in the Himalayas, talking to the snow deep in solitude, able to congratulate the star. But you are just a Jew, only a Jew. Your work in the cemetery, going from stone to stone, talking to the dead, preaching to the bones. You were a diamond merchant, but they dragged your ass into the field and put an apple in your mouth. You dreamed of a city, but they stuffed you with themselves, and they wail and fight and bulldoze and plow and pray and shit and play dead and make love. You gave them a candle and told them to shove it from both ends. There's a reference there to the monk of the mountains, and that's Milarepa of the Thousand Songs, who made this great statement. Even the person meditating in a cave is contributing to the world. Because I thought last night, what a thing to think about it. 2 a.m, I was thinking about all the poets who didn't write about the slaughter in the Holocaust, and artists as well. There's Picasso in Paris in his studio. There's Camus and Sartre and this one and that one. And Picasso's best friend was taken off to Auschwitz and killed there. And nary a word. And then that's sort of happening now. Father's Day on Mother's... Father's poem on Mother's Day. I have a typo. It says Father's Poe. P-O-E. So he was tough. Father was tough and quiet. He should have found success as director of a library system. You know what I mean? He was a hobo and handsome. He loved his mother for 70 years. He loved his wife for 50 years. He despised rich people for 97 years. He sang Onward Christian Soldiers when drunk, and when very drunk, he'd want to beat the crap out of someone. It only took me 65 years to be able to tell him how much I loved seeing him on a freight train crossing Montana or entering the yards in Chicago. The world is tough. My world is loud, tyrannized by fear and loathing, trained to be kind or vicious. Today turns Sunday, spirits, flower, prance, and a lanky kid on skateboard whistles down our block.
Yeah.
So that's the first poem of mine I saw in Bangla, which is a language that the guy Arshad Siddiqui, the translator, lives in Dhaka. He said, Neely, on the Facebook phone, 300 million people speak my language and 30 of them read modern poetry. 300 million speak it. And he said, 30 of them read modern poetry. Then he laughed. But he's doing a selected poems in Bangla, and I'm really honored. And we didn't mention that list. There's a selected coming out in Greece, along with the book of Gregory Corso. So I feel really in great company. And that's Yanis Livadis, who's a very great poet. And he lives in Paris, and Jesse and I met him there a couple years back. Forever the sky is black. My wound turns blue. Forever truth lies in sand alongside animal tracks. Forever the mind grows green as hair turns into snow. Forever fingers tap on wood, make the deer part glow. Forever I touch you sleeping, pretending you are a forest on an undisclosed island. Men travel on motorized logs. Hamadryad sings aloud. Forever, ever bleeds a river over rude, dusty plains. My wound is a portal. This is where the sun rests when it is done with traveling. This is called Courtyard Ode, and it's in the book of odes I mentioned that I wrote for Confucius and Pound. So I say I'm a nature poet, but I also feel like I'm a, in a way, the word religion is so loaded, but I'm a religious poet in the sense that I believe, I think poetry is one way that we identify with what we like to think of as the sacred. And that's very difficult for me. I remember Bukowski told me, he said something very interesting, at least it was to me, and this is just in my head because it was never written down. He said, we were talking about education, he said, you know, it's like a seed you drop out the window and it grows upward into the sky and upward into God, if there is a God. And if there isn't a God, upward into God anyway, because that's the way it works. And maybe that's why we were friends, because that's sort of the way I feel. I mean, and I, maybe because I'm older now, like a few people here, and death is closer, I'm trying to reinvent a creator who will take me in. It's a utilitarian thing. And I don't know if it's real or not, but it seems to be working. It makes me happier. And it makes me think more intentionally about trying to write poetry that matters, mostly, of course, to me, and then hoping it might connect with others. Because I found out a little bit of recognition goes a long way for yourself, you know. I mean, I can't sit like Buddha in my garden, cross-legged, and just be happy writing for myself. I want to share it. You might sketch a courtyard of silver bells and orange trees. The trees are part and parcel of the cathedral complex. Sun no less present than in poems from the early Tang. A lynx on fire, bowman on a vase, frost and old age clinging to stones. We walked up the circular staircase and saw a blizzard of pagodas, the lynx again, screed of monkeys and bamboo. We walked through the Kolonoki to an exhibition, black flag in the distance, a few Greek letters floating overhead, a mirage of subway cars, the outline for a city built of gold. Nanos chants a few lines from the Odyssey, while Kavafi came of age to the south. I notice letters flying out of the mouth of the Alexandrian poet, a treasure after his death. No man could suffer more the image of a youth smoking cigarettes at a cafe entranceway, or write of neglected settlements on periphery of the ancient Greek world. Butterflies flying free from the words of many poets. Who is a bad poet? Mediocre, yes. Plain out bad, difficult to find. A tower of salt, orange, blossom, ashes, roses, the opening line of the cantos. I go away, tasting of sea salt and nasty breezes, time-honored sea turns. Gates swing open with a creak. Grasshoppers lean on branches. He owns these trees. God and his assistants walk through rows of darkness. History surfaces to sleep on a green bench. Sorry, Jack, here in the courtyard, only success, solace, shelter. There are no bad poets. The desert wind may breach these walls, and that is fine. there will be only gratitude for the taking. A steady flame between trees, golden branches and orange petals for you, for all awakened ones. The pharmacist had a kind mother. She sits on one of the benches, recalling the old days and traditional ways. She saw the Turks swarm into town, swords on the tip of time. I wanted to write poetry, confessed the pharmacist, who is measuring powder and vials of liquid. Calimera, good morning. I will sail to the port of Haifa on a Chinese drunk from the harbor of Piraeus. In his courtyard, father tried to reconcile a long life with a sad image of passage. In any case, thou wilt give thanks. You spend the night in Satan's shadow. I am the owner, says the druggist. He lifts the key to underscore his fortune and given place. I don't know how many of you know North of Boston by Robert Frost, the book. You know that book? The first poem is a sonnet. One of my wishes is that those dark trees, so scarce and old, they seldom show the breeze, were not as 'twere the merest mask of gloom, but stretched away unto the edge of doom. And he had those lines, I read at my mother's funeral, forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. And that's the kind of wisdom he had. But so I was thinking of North of Boston being here, and I wrote this yesterday. And I've been building angels with this theory about building a god again. And I'm very close to Rilke and his in the Duino elegies, it really depends on the all angels are terrible. And what does he mean by that, Do you wish another angel? Have we not had enough in our empire of sprinkling systems and anxious looks from across the room? What do you wish to hear from the angel? You might consider turning over a gold coin and admire an eagle's wing. Angel, sweet and slender, did I not find you alone one day, reaching for crows in splendid sky? Hear those birds today, as loud as ever. They may also knit in silence under oil lamps of the parlor. Be a clown and cover me in denim. Show me how to tame the rough seacoast where troublesome boulders abound. Your mother rises from salt. She tries backing you into a pit. Oh, I need to plead an angel anyway. 127 is the scenic route. Beautiful farmers baling hay of a Tuesday noon. Commuter train from Boston. This is North of Boston. Out a ways. My wish is to back away and gain perspective. Be blessed if you are haunted. Light and death will do you well. So that's my tone poem to this place.
Neely, why don't you read that one you wrote to
Which one?
Vince.
About Vince?
Yeah.
If I can find it. Because
his house.
I wrote it on here, and here's one on T.S. Eliot. So I noticed that the Eliot house is being enshrined, right?
Yeah.
Millions of dollars going into it. It was their summer home. They lived in St. Louis. They had a big mansion. And they stayed there when the neighborhood changed. The neighborhood became multicultural, and because it was a gateway from the South. But the family stayed in this big mansion. But when they came here, it was just, it was very secure and lily white and all that. And we know that he drew on, especially four quartets with the dry sauvages and all that, he drew from his time here, so it's important. But this is an odd poem. Why bother complaining over the misery in T.S. Eliot's poems? Buy Wedgwood china, consider patterns on a plate, compare and contrast delicate profiles, imagine the poet riding on a leopard's back. Your heart sails above the clouds, looking down on London town, your fingers forever conduits for philosophical speculation. Personal emancipation remains for the impeccable American emigre. He dressed impeccably and held a few Jews in high regard. His mother compared the Jewish people to loathsome animals. No, the son is never the mother of morbid joy. The rising sun rules over our questions. We were born in St. Louis and graduated from Harvard. Language is a monster. Words are mirrors. Our father is an executioner who pumps death into the hummingbird and plucks her from the garden where she thrived. Our mother is a Jew, like all mothers. She walks into the shadow kingdom and wears a crown of thorns from the red tinted rose. So, and this is a poet I love. My God, what do I do? Poet I don't love, Jesus. Henry, I'm looking for the poem to Vincent. I never read a lot of Vincent Farini. I mean, I read him and loved him always, but it wasn't until here that I really started looking through the books. And I told Henry that I think he wrote that put down of Vincent probably because he wanted to be the only poet in Gloucester. Olson wanted to be, yeah. Is what I'm thinking. And now Eliot comes in, you know, without even trying. He's been dead since 65.
As if there weren't poets born here.
Yeah. What are you going to do? And you know, it's all very confusing because you know where Robert Frost was born? My city, San Francisco. Spent his early boyhood there, and he has four or five, the poet of New England. What are you going to do? I know what I'm going to do. Here. I keep falling in and out of the sky because I want to, not on account of anybody else. If they told me to stop, I'd simply punish the air with differences and go down. I am angry at people in airport seats, clutching their bags, straining themselves, and I am angry at the morning dove who visited one afternoon, then disappeared forever. I go up and I go down. Buddha is not my idol, but he accepts me and even puts a hand over my shoulders. He goes in and out of the temple complex. He plays a gong which sweetens the air. I come and go despite the grave nuclear devices planted in the ground. Ice melts, sea rises, human garbage fills the ocean. Our water is poisoned. A handful of people own the planet. I rise and fall like the Roman Empire because I want to. It's what I do best. So just a couple more, and I'm still going to look for the Farini.
Do you want to try these glasses?
Say what? I can't hear.
You want to try our glasses?
No, no. I have everything's wrong. My ears, my glasses, everything.
Me too.
Hello. I am the way I am because nothing and nobody could convince me to be otherwise. A simple thought to be not so easily deterred from the wreckage of bad behavior. It's okay to say yes when you mean no. It's okay to do your best for yourself while you grow old, because no one really cares, not even if they want to. I am the way I am out of spite. I hold the Appalachian poet in high regard and take it for myself. A simple line or two will go. The sun is also big in life. It doesn't know when you will die, but it shines. I am as I am, tending the garden, fearful of court documents, wary of tax forms. I never learn how to pry open a box of butterflies, subservient only to the blind musician and his futile horn. I am the way I am, capable of secrets despite my big mouth. I turn up the volume and listen to the real news, angry mobs in Budapest, trouble on the streets of Beijing. It's always a disaster, not one of us spared in the grand and glorious scheme. A white butterfly. So I go into my garden and I look for birds. I had a mourning dove about a month ago, and every once in a while we get these huge bluebirds that come in, and they seem vicious, and they squawk a lot and all that, and they shit all over everything. But recently there's been no birds, and it made me very angry. And I go in the front, the guy's house next door is filled with birds, and they're trilling, and it's amazing. But I look for butterflies too, and I wrote this poem about a week ago, and the next afternoon, a white butterfly came and sat right beside me. Wise words for those who sleep as I have, who know what I'll never know. Turnabout filled with truckers who negotiate chained interiors in order to drink coffee from styrofoam cups while waiting for the light to change. White butterfly comes to settle on the wheel of a machine digging into my heart. I'm sleeping and walking into Nobo Daddy's lair where rooftops pop out of concrete. White butterflies congregate on the pediments. Loners loom in a crowd. Odd ones ride alongside Orpheus. I love to hold a moment across decades in order to look. A rustic fence is where the butterfly first appeared, one of her claws in an armada. Love is a multitude, dear friend. Off to work, I'm going to be 85 one afternoon, walking not so easily. What the hell? Nothing better than to descend into pits of lava. White wings appear. I adore brave librarians dropping out of a tournament in hell, forgetting and learning all night long and into a cathedral of wet leaves down to the butterfly, roaming in rush hour through the wilds of traffic and horns. Men will perish. Butterflies live with difficulty. Trucks pull up to the scales in a hailstorm. Books become gasoline and oil. Rose petals fade into pages of purgatorio. The white butterfly has to decide Highway 101 or Highway 99. What difference will it make? Please, my love, bring me home. And this will be the last poem. Who knows, anybody know the La Brea Tar Pits?
Sure.
Here?
Yeah.
La Brea Tar Pits are in L.A., in what was called Hancock Park, which was a big ranch. And they were discovered in the late 19th century. There were some indigenous people preserved in the tar, dinosaur bones, saber-toothed cats, and all that stuff, you know. So I got many poems on Los Angeles that they'll be in my new book. One is called Arroyo Seco. It's the first freeway, 1938, from L.A. to Pasadena. And before they, while they were building the freeway, they ripped up the Pacific Electric Railway, which was about 70,000 miles of non-pollutant track. And that was done by the gasoline companies and the politicians. And they got rid of it. And it got people like from Los Angeles to San Bernardino in 55 minutes. It takes longer than that now in the automobile. Anyway, it's the way it is. Humble art tumbles out of the tar pits. Mastodon, an early hunter. Jug of water from cool garden spot long ago, long before archaeology and penance. We'd file in and gape, listen to gray, bony man describe circumstances, rings of tar, prehistoric misery, saber-toothed cat, bribery rampant, a box of violence. Then, home on a school bus, we drew dinosaurs in class, and then we went to a museum where Van Gogh was on exhibition next door to a brontosaurus. Time forever weighing what is known or unknown. I moved my eyes across granite cliffs on the white sky. My aunt and uncle owned a coat factory down the street from the tar pits back in the old days. He was a skeleton and she a Venus, always eating from a box of chocolates. They are gone. The tar pits remain and remind us of time. We find enough insanity. What could life have been like in the hot afternoon with no direction, without a code? We were children and told to keep our mouths shut, stand in line as we pass through the gate of yellow bars. Thank you so much.